Our podcast reviews well-known movies and contains spoilers. The podcast may contain mature subject matter and mature language. Listener discretion is advised. Enjoy the show.
Quiet on set. Places, everybody. And action.
It's time once again for the Hooked on Movies podcast. Today's movie is the third in a series celebrating people we have lost in 2023. The movie, The Whole Nine Yards, released in 2000, is celebrating the life and acting career of Matthew Perry, who passed away on October 28th. With me are Ken.
Okay, guys, if you screw this up, I would really hate to have to kill you. I would hate it more than mayonnaise, and you know how much I hate mayonnaise.
And Ted.
Friends do not engage in sexual congress with each other's wives.
Oops.
Oops. And I'm Eric. And you know, I can't think of nothing finer than a fine naked woman holding a gun. All right. We're talking The Whole Nine Yards. Ken, tell us a synopsis of this movie.
Jimmy the Tulip is a mob hitman turned informant, ratted on the mob and put his life in jeopardy. Now he has to move to suburban Montreal to make a new start. His next-door neighbor is a mild-mannered, unhappy married dentist, Oz. Oz recognizes Jimmy from the newspaper stories about the mob testimony. That's when Nick's simple, boring world turns upside down.
Ted, tell us the particulars of The Whole Nine Yards.
Okay, so The Whole Nine Yards is directed by Jonathan Lynn. It was a screenplay by Mitchell Kapner. It has a running time of 98 minutes, a release date of February 18th, 2000, a budget of $41.3 million, a box office gross of $106.4 million. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a critic score of a splat of 43% and an audience score of 64%. The Whole Nine Yards stars Bruce Willis as Jimmy the Tulip Tedeschi, Matthew Perry as Nicholas Oz Ozaransky, Rosanna Arquette as Sophie Ozaransky, Michael Clark Duncan as Frankie Figgs, Natasha Henstridge as Cynthia, Amanda Peet as Jill, and Kevin Pollak as Yanni Gogolak.
Thanks, Ted. Let's talk about the first time we saw this movie. How about you, Ken? I'm assuming cable. That's my usual go-to.
Oh, yes. Probably the first year I was out on cable, and this was a mainstay for many years.
Okay. How many years ago was that?
Yeah. Probably 2001. So probably for the next 5 to 10 years, I was probably
sounds like a jail term. 5 to 10 years. Yeah.
5 to 10 years.
That's right. How about you, Ted?
I don't remember when I first saw the movie, actually, but it's been one of those movies that I remember owning on VHS before my wife sold all my VHSs at a yard sale.
Dude, that's so criminal.
Oh, yeah. That's actually a more interesting story than when I first seen the movie. But no, it's a movie that I enjoyed. I remember in 2000, I got a job when I first moved up to the Chicagoland area to be with my now wife. I got a job with Hollywood Video, and it was a very popular rental.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, I do run a charity, a 401(c) for wayward VHS tapes. If anyone is interested and has any, I do accept donations of all video media. Just throwing that out there. Mm-hmm. So I, too, as well, had a VHS copy of this movie. A friend of mine, who shall rename nameless, gave me a DVD copy of it. So I watched that. And I know. Ken, yeah. So. I saw this movie probably on a rental as well, probably a couple years after it came out. And here we are watching it again and talking about it. How exciting is that?
We'll find out.
Yeah, we'll find out with our reviews at the end of the podcast here about it. So, Ken, let's go into part one of the movie.
All right. Oz is a likable Montreal-based dentist from Chicago, but is hated by his wife, Sophie, and her mother. Oz meets a new neighbor and realizes he is Jimmy the Tulip Tedeschi, an infamous Chicago contract killer with a bounty on his head. Oz reveals Jimmy's identity to Sophie. Oz befriends Jimmy and shares that his business partner, Sophie's father, was involved with an underage boy and embezzled from the practice to pay off the boy's family before committing suicide, leaving Oz deeply in debt. Oz returns home, where Sophie has arranged for him to fly to Chicago and share Jimmy's whereabouts with mob boss Yanni Gogolak for a reward. Oz is reluctant but flies to Chicago. Arriving in Chicago, as Oz has no intention of giving Jimmy up, at his hotel he meets Frankie Figgs, Yanni's enforcer, and denies any knowledge of Jimmy. But Frankie beats the shit out of him and brings him to Yanni's estate. He meets Cynthia, Jimmy's estranged wife, and Yanni instructs Frankie to accompany Oz back home and keep an eye on Jimmy until Yanni and his men can take him out. At the hotel, Oz calls Jimmy to warn him, but is told Jimmy knows what Oz has done. Cynthia arrives and tells Oz that Yanni and Jimmy both want each other and Cynthia dead to collect a $10 million trust, the whole nine yards. Oz and Cynthia sleep together, and he vows to protect her. And that's the end of part one.
Okay, so this thing kicks off with them at the house in suburban Montreal. What are the odds of that? How did he write this movie and say, hey, let's have a Chicago dentist move to suburban Montreal with his wife who is from, what, some Eastern Bloc country?
She's actually from Canada. That's why they moved
that
up there.
That is not a Canadian accent. No, stop
it. It's supposed to be a French-Canadian accent. French-Canadian
accent. Not French. Are you serious?
It's not.
I thought they were like Lithuanian or Slovakian. That is not French-Canadian.
Yeah, I know.
I was listening to the director's commentary.
Oh, my goodness.
On this, and he was really, really complimented her on it. And I was like,
no,
this is one of the worst parts of the film is her accent. It just drives me up the wall.
It's really bad.
It's very disappointing for somebody of the caliber of Rosanna Arquette, who is a good actress. It's not the only accent here that I have an issue with.
Right.
What's the other accent? Is it
Kevin Pollak's accent?
Oh, yes. Thank you. That's absolutely right. That's pretty bad. We'll get into that later in part two,
Shatner,
most likely.
Yeah, throughout the whole thing.
He should have done Shatner. He does a great Shatner. That's right.
It's just
a mob boss
ridiculous.
With a personality complex who thinks he's William Shatner. Now, that would have been funny.
Or then he switches over to Christopher Walken, and then he just keeps on changing his accent around. Yeah, because he's not the main mob boss. He's the son of the mob boss.
Right. Well,
originally, this film was supposed to take place in Florida. I think they got a better deal taking it up to Canada, and I think that's
most likely. That's why.
How ironic, though, that a lot of your sitcoms and stuff are filmed in Toronto,
right?
Or Vancouver,
Chicago.
Yeah, and they say it's like Chicago. Well, you know, you don't have any palm trees in Montreal, so it might be a little hard to pull off. But surprising, they kept it with Montreal.
But the thing with Kevin Pollak, too, is like there's a guy who, like you guys were saying, he does a lot of impersonations. He knows how to do accents. And this was just, I don't know, it was stupid. Because I was trying to figure out, is he supposed to be doing a Southside Chicago accent? But no, it's like supposed to be like some Eastern European country accent. It's like, it's just ridiculous.
His accent was more believable than
hers,
Arquette's accent.
Yeah. The problem, though, is you have to turn on the closed caption to figure out what he's saying. Because he just keeps mumbling.
I think that's part of the joke, because later on in the movie, Matthew Perry doesn't understand what he says. So I think that's part of the joke. But it's unfortunate because, like you said, Ted, Arquette is a really good actress. This just made her
weak. It was really weak. I mean, with that accent and her mother, and with that accent, French Canadian, whatever, you could have put any actress in there and just did some bullshit accent and just went with it. That's how weak it was. She didn't even need to be a good actress.
Well, the mother sounded at least appropriate, but we don't even know who that actress is. So it's easy for us not to, Arquette, we know her. We've seen her movies before. So we know when she does this accent, it's over the top. Maybe that's the problem, is we know it's over the top a little bit. And this whole movie's over the top, so maybe that's why they kept it.
Yeah.
This movie is clearly Chandler Bing as a dentist. I mean, all his mannerisms, he's going to the car and beating his head on the steering wheel and screaming and losing it. That's all so Friends-esque stuff that Chandler Bing would do.
And actually, I think that's something that Matthew Perry did on his own, beating up the car in the driveway and then going down the driveway and doing it again. So,
yeah.
And it makes you wonder, how did these two people get together in the first place?
Yeah.
Making her kind of evil. There's no redeeming quality to her. I feel
none
like
whatsoever.
You should give her some redeeming qualities to let us know why Oz married her in the first place.
So what did he do? He fled Chicago because of the issues and somehow ended up in Montreal. Is that what happened?
I think it's cheaper up there.
He fled the country?
And his wife and his mother-in-law are from there. So I guess when everything went down, when her dad committed suicide, they fled there. I don't know.
That would have been cool if they would have thrown in like flashbacks of how they met or how they actually fell in love. Because I don't see these two coercing at all. They're just like, you know, vinegar and water. There's no love, nothing at all. He's just afraid financially that she's going to take him to the cleaners or apparently, as we know, try to have him killed.
The thing is that her and her mother kind of like sit there at the breakfast table and they're basically like, I wish she would die.
Yeah. Yeah. Die already.
It's like, why couldn't you pretend to like him? And then and behind the scenes, you're making all those plans to kill him for the money. I mean, that would have worked out a whole lot better, I think, in that situation. I think it was just too upfront with her being disgusted with him. And you could still have him being disgusted with her. That sometimes that happens with marriages. People after like 5-10 years can't stand each other. You could still have done that. I just think making them seem like they're not compatible from day one doesn't make any sense.
How long are they supposed to be married for? A couple years?
They don't really say.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
They never really
say.
Ultimately, the problem that we've got here is a writing problem where the reason that she doesn't like him doesn't equal the amount of vitriol that she has for him. Because ultimately, he's paying her dad's wayward ways.
Yeah. Debts. Yeah, he's paying the debt.
It's like she's punishing him for paying.
And she doesn't work, does she?
And no, she doesn't work.
She says, you can go get a job.
You go get
like,
a job.
She's like, no.
She just sits at home and smokes with her mom.
And it's weird because they kind of do the Goodfellas thing where she asks him for money and he goes, well, how much? And instead of doing the Ray Liotta thing or the Lorraine Bracco thing where she puts, you know, her fingers to show how much money she wants, she goes 5. And it's like, you know, all right, so I see what you're doing. The whole idea of why the two of them hate him ends up being kind of ridiculous. And
yeah, why did you get married? Was there any love at all? We don't see it, and I just don't get it.
It is satisfactory when she does get what she's got coming to her.
Yes, it is.
So I will say this, as far as the character goes, it pays off in the end. Even though it's not set up the way that normally you would really like it to be, the payoff in the end is definitely worth it. But yeah, she's a very maddening character. It's just like, really, man? It's like, wow.
You know, going back to what you were saying about Goodfellas, the beginning of the film, they like are focusing on like teeth and things of that nature and the dentist while he's brushing his teeth. And the music that they're playing reminded me of some kind of thing I would hear in The Untouchables, the movie Untouchables. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's kind of interesting. I know the director focused on having a jazzy type of sound to it.
Yeah.
But the opening is kind of a very interesting mafia sounding score, which I thought was kind of cool in a sense.
This soundtrack is Jerry Goldstein, isn't it?
No, it's Danny Elfman.
Are you sure?
Yeah, because I made sure to check it the second time I watched it.
Oh, I thought it was Goldstein who did this. Mm-hmm. All right. Danny Elfman? Oh, poor Danny. Oh, you can do better than that.
Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah, you're right, Ken. It did seem to try and be like jazzy and kind of...
Oh, well, they go to a jazz club.
Yeah.
I like Matthew Perry here. I think Matthew Perry does a really good job. I mean, yeah, he does do a lot of Chandler Bing-ish type of comedy, but there's also some old school comedy. He does like a Honeymooners thing, which based off of how his wife treats him, it kind of makes some sense, some of the comic stuff that he does. But he also, and the old school kind of physical comedy where he runs into the sliding glass door.
That is very funny, actually.
Yeah,
yes.
He does a really good job here with what is given Because let's face it, the writing here is, it's mediocre. I mean, it's above average, slightly above average. It's a very busy script. We'll put it that way.
Busy meaning what?
They try to stash 10 pounds of crap into a 5-pound bag.
Yeah.
Oz is a very relatable and everyman type of a person. And that's probably what was appealing about Chandler Bing, too.
Well, yeah.
But
clearly they're jumping on the Friends bandwagon, getting him in the movie.
Oh, sure they are.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting with Matthew Perry, Bruce Willis was on board before Matthew Perry was on board. But Matthew Perry liked the script because it reminded him, and I'm linking these two together since they both died in 2023, he was a big fan of The In-Laws with Alan Arkin.
Oh, that's a great movie. Oh, yeah.
And so when he was reading this script, because Alan Arkin plays a dentist in that film, he related it to that, and he was a big fan of that film.
You know, I haven't seen that movie in a long time, Arkin and Peter Falk in that movie. But you're right. Now that you bring that up, I definitely can see a little bit of similarities between his character and Alan Arkin's character in that movie. Well, hell, now I want to watch. Now I want to watch that.
You know, Matthew Perry, he's just very gifted in the sense that, like you just said, Ted, he comes off as an everyday person, but he's kind of that quick-witted, just lovable goof that, you know, everybody wants to kind of like hang around with. Him adding the physical comedy to it just added to the character. He seemed to be having a lot of fun with this character. And I've seen him in other movies, and one of the other movies we were talking about is Fools Rush In with Selma Hayek. And that one, he's likable, but he doesn't seem like he's having fun. In this movie, I feel like he's having fun. I think everybody in this movie is having fun. I think that's why it works the way it works.
You know, we have to really say, if we're talking positives of Matthew Perry, Matthew Perry is generally known, obviously, as Chandler Bing from Friends. Unfortunately, in that character, he's really typecast into that kind of sarcastic, likable, lovable guy who actually throws in a little bit of physical comedy. He never really went out and did a lot of movies. You never saw Matthew Perry in a real dramatic role, or you never saw Matthew Perry as, you know, an evil, you know, homicidal killer. You know, he's always going to be playing that character that is reminiscent of what America knows about Matthew Perry. And it's sad that we lost him, because I think that he probably, if he would have lived on, and I did read his autobiography that came out last year. In fact, I bought a copy of it probably the first month, because I really, really am a big Matthew Perry fan. And he had so many demons that he was covering up and making comebacks and doing this and doing that, that I think we would have seen a lot more dramatic roles from him in later life, possibly. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, he did have a couple of dramatic roles, not in movies, but in TV. He had some role guest spots in like The West Wing. And one of my favorite underrated shows, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
True. It did have some dramatic parts, but even that was a little bit more of that sarcastic, dark comedy. But yeah, that's a good point. That did have some dramatic roles in that. A very, very good underrated TV show.
I think it shows his range in those shows. It shows that he can pull it off. It reminds me a little bit of Michael J. Fox. Michael J. Fox, when he was in Family Ties, you know, he's always the funny guy, almost a similar type of quick-witted type of humor. Michael J. Fox also added like physical comedy to the roles that he was in. But then Michael J. Fox also showed us, like in The American President, that he can do drama as well. And I think these two actors are very similar, their approach to acting.
That's good. I definitely see that you've brought that up. They do have a lot of similarities. And I like both of them personally.
I think that had he lived, there would have been a renaissance for his career. Yeah, it is. It's very tragic what happened.
I mean, he tried multiple times to bring back his career. He started in a remake of The Odd Couple TV show, which I actually personally enjoy. He also had a couple of other failed TV shows that were decent. They just, it just wasn't Chandler Bing. So I think people, tuned out once they didn't see it was the same character.
Yeah, definitely typecast.
Getting back to the whole nine yards, Ken, it's funny that you, before I go on, you mentioned that it seemed like everybody was having fun. In Roger Ebert's review of the movie, he talked about that a lot, that it seemed like everybody was having a good time making the movie. So I wanted to touch on that really quick. Bruce Willis here he's very fun in this role. And you don't actually see Bruce Willis be fun a whole lot. This was a little bit of a departure from his normal characters. And I think that was refreshing, because at this point in time in 2000, you talk about being typecast, is almost like he was playing his same character in every movie, which is kind of what The Expendables makes fun of, that all those guys are playing the exact same roles that they've always played in their entire careers. And of course,
it's funny because he got his start off in comedy with, like we said, with Moonlighting and Blind Date with Kim Basinger. If I know Erica knows that movie probably pretty well. John Larroquette.
Oh, yes. Blind Date is late 80s. I think it's 87, if I remember right. That is a great movie.
He has comedic chops. He really
sure
does.
Sure he does.
I think when Die Hard came out, I think everything just focused on those type of movies, as Ted's was basically stating.
I think Bruce Willis actually pulled off being a hired gun in this movie. Mm-hmm. I kind of believed your Teddy the Tool Up story. He has that look about him. He had the mannerisms. I believed he was a contract killer.
He's really good here. The other person that's really good too, I think Amanda Peet does a really good job. I think she's funny. It is a little bit over the top, but I think that the character kind of calls for it to be. She provides a lot of the interest, some very interesting parts of the movie as far as how fast she talks and the fact that she's a contract killer. I love when she finally meets Jimmy and they're going back and forth. And I don't know. It's a fun character. I think it's one of the best things that she's done. But she brings a lot of energy to the role. And I think where that role could have just been kind of a dead role, she breathes life into it, in my opinion.
I think what works for that role is the fact that she comes off as being Oz's best friend.
Right.
And Oz needs a friend in all of this, and it's her.
And she almost comes out like she's hitting on him.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. I could see that. And she's a very attractive lady. And there's things that I like her in. One of the shows that I liked her was the first season of Brockmire. It's about a sports broadcaster.
That's right. Yeah.
She owns a minor league baseball team. She is fun. I do think you're right, Ted. I think sometimes it's a little bit over the top. And we'll talk about it later on in part two of the movie. But for whatever reason, the age difference between her and Bruce Willis doesn't seem to be a factor here. I don't think about that he's much older than her. Like I said, I think it's because they're all having fun. And they're not taking themselves too seriously.
And he's still technically married, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Married to Cynthia.
Still, and we'll talk about that in part two, obviously, but still technically married. But I liked Amanda Peet in this. I thought her role was a little over the top in some instances. Obviously, in other instances, we know why the movie has an R rating. We'll talk about that in part two. But she's not bad. I mean, I thought the fact that we were kind of going into it, that she actually is a hired killer as well. Honestly, I didn't see that coming. I really thought that she was just hitting on him and just like, oh, he's cute. He's a dentist. Yeah. Why are you in such a bad marriage? Why don't you leave your wife? You know, when they're out there having coffee at the cafe, I'm like, oh yeah, she wants him.
And of course, the favorite, part of the movie starts there is the mayonnaise on the hamburger.
Yes. Yes. Total flips out. Yeah.
And I agree with Bruce Willis, later on when he says, the only thing you should put on a hamburger is ketchup. And then maybe that kind of sauce, which I think has some mayonnaise in it. Actually, that's all improvised from Bruce Willis.
It is completely improvised. And it is funny. The Canadians love their mayonnaise. Oh my goodness, they love their mayonnaise on everything. It's crazy. Cheese curds, poutine, they put mayonnaise on everything.
I think the chemistry between Willis and Matthew Perry is, I mean, when they go into town or wherever they are, it's fun. They're sharing their life stories. Well, at least Oz is sharing his life with him. And I think that allows that bonding. It feels legit. It doesn't feel forced. And I think that comes with Matthew Perry and Oz's character, because throughout the movie, you know, they talk about how sweet of a guy he is. And people want to be his friend because of how just likable his character is. I like how they established their relationship.
He comes off very genuine. Well, Jimmy and Oz are the two best written characters in the movie, in my opinion. And I guess it is their movie, essentially.
Yeah, but there's been other times where we like cop out with Bruce Willis and Tracy Morgan.
Come on.
You know, they don't connect like how we see these two characters connect. And I think it's just that sharing life together.
The problem with cop out was that Willis
Kevin Smith
didn't respect Kevin Smith as a director.
Well, maybe and he shouldn't.
Tried to big time him and take over the production. No, there's more problems with cop out than
that's a lot of problems.
It's a disaster with cop out.
But I mean, we see Bruce Willis having that chemistry with someone like Samuel L. Jackson in Die Hard. There, he does have the ability to have really good chemistry with other people. It's their chemistry throughout the film that really pushes this along. Michael Duncan, he's a nice little third wheel to this. I mean, every time he's on the screen, he's very enjoyable. I love when he's there when Oz meets him for the first time.
Right.
And he just keeps on pounding on him.
Yeah.
But he's really nice about it.
Sure.
He's a sweet guy. He's like a sweet, you know, hitman. But he keeps on hitting him in the, you know, in the ribs and kidneys and things of that nature. And he's like, aren't you going to scream for help? And he's like, will it do any good? Nope. Yeah. It's a shame he passed away as well, because there are a number of films that he's been in that I've enjoyed him as well. He's the perfect third wheel here, where he's very likable. And I love Kevin Pollak, but I think Kevin Pollak is, like we talked about earlier with the accent, it undermined his character and
yes,
made it very too cartoonish.
Very much so.
Because he is a good actor. We've seen him in multiple things, Usual Suspects, A Few Good Men. I mean, he knows how to act. And we talked about his impressions and things of that nature. He could have been very funny here. In fact, out of all these people, he might be the funniest guy in this group.
Very possible.
The script basically makes him unfunny.
And he's trying to be funny. And it just doesn't work for me.
It's a miscast if this is how you wanted your mafia boss to be. So Kevin Pollak, if you let Kevin Pollak be Kevin Pollak in the film, I think would have benefited here. It seems like you try to put him in a box and it just doesn't work.
Was he trying to be some type of like Marlon Brando character?
Don't know.
A godfather that you couldn't understand? Because he was not good in this movie. You could have replaced him with practically anyone else who couldn't understand what they're talking about.
The fact that Cynthia is married to Jimmy, and then, of course, Oz falls in love with her, is like...
Pretty cliche, to me, actually, if you think about it.
It's very forced, in my opinion, and it's like, it really didn't need to happen.
There's a lot of things in this movie that didn't need to happen, but they did happen.
Right.
Cynthia's character kind of comes off being kind of stale a little bit. I mean, she's playing the straight person to Matthew Perry's comedy, but it's a little too straight. It's a little too prim and proper. I don't see the chemistry really
there. She comes off as too smart for everybody in the movie.
That's a good way of putting it.
And the writers use her as a almost kind of like a hammer to hit plot points over the head about trying to explain what's going to happen. And it's like, okay, her character gives a lot of exposition to the audience as far as what's going to happen. It's like, come on, we can figure it out. What's going to happen here? And it's like her character spells it out for everybody. Did she have to be Jimmy's wife? The whole thing with the three of them have to sign for, it's a very convoluted way to come up with the end of the movie.
Yeah, love a hitman that doesn't believe in divorce but doesn't mind killing her off. So
that's actually kind of funny. I kind of get that. That's fine. It's one of his many idiosyncrasies. All of these characters have idiosyncrasies except for Cynthia. She's, like you said, she's straight. And she's comes off as cardboard.
You know, I think it would have been better suited if she was introduced a different way. Like, let's say that they're in Chicago and he bumps into her at the restaurant. Like, accidentally runs into her. She drops things that she's holding. He helps fix it up. They say some things back and forth.
Oh, wow. That's really cliche right there.
It is cliche. But it sets it up so when they are meeting again at Yanni's, that he has some time to think about her and then sees her again, you know, building up that relationship, building up that desire that he has for her. I mean, by the time he sees her for the second time, he's like totally in love with her.
Yeah, he jumps into bed practically.
Yeah.
Well, it is Natasha Henstridge. I mean,
come on. Yeah. And he did have oysters, so that could have helped out.
That's true. He did have oysters. Yes, of course.
I think that's one of the things that probably is an issue here with the writing, where it seems like everything's put on fast forward. If they would have taken some of the plot points out, they could have let other things marinate and had a more well-rounded script. This is, like I said, they tried to force so much in. And it's like, because then you have the scene with Rosanna Arquette, and she's with the, I guess he's an under, why he had to be an undercover cop.
Right.
Here again,
why does she have to screw an undercover cop too?
They're trying too hard. I don't know.
Yeah, I've got a few things to mention in part two, obviously.
Yeah.
Why don't we go ahead and do part two then?
Why don't we, Ken? Bring us. What a great segue. Bring us into part two.
That's what I'm here for. All right. In Canada, Frankie and Oz meet Jimmy, who reveals he and Frankie are planning to kill Yanni and Cynthia. Jimmy explains Sophie tried to hire him to kill Oz, and he plans to lure Yanni to Montreal. Jimmy offers to kill Sophie, which Oz declines. At work, Oz tells Jill everything. She reveals that she, too, is a contract killer, hired by Sophie to kill Oz. Jill liked him too much, however, and canceled the hit. She demands to meet her hero, Jimmy, who enlists her help. Cynthia warns Oz that Yanni will kill him after killing Jimmy. The two watch as the gang walks into the ambush. Down the street, Sophie meets with another hitman. But when he recognizes Yanni, Sophie explains the situation. He heads for the house with a gun, taking the car keys with him. Inside, Yanni is distracted by a naked Jill, which Eric appreciates that. Jimmy and Jill kill Yanni and his men. Oz and Cynthia drive away as Jimmy also shoots Sophie's hitman, and they discover that he is an undercover detective. As they dispose of the bodies, Oz calls and suggests a deal to benefit everyone. At his office, he alters the dead detective's teeth to match Jimmy's dental records, then sets his and Yanni's bodies on fire in Oz's car. Investigators find the remains and believe Yanni and Jimmy are dead, and while heading to Oz's house with the intent to arrest him, discover a recorder in the detective's car. Sophie's conversation about killing Oz sends her and her mother to prison. Cynthia makes a deal to give Jimmy the $10 million in exchange for her and Oz's life. While Cynthia and Jill, who have just met face-to-face, are at the bank, Jimmy and Frank take Oz onto a yacht. Jill urges Cynthia to split the money with her and run, leaving Oz to be killed by Jimmy. But Cynthia realizes she loves Oz and refuses to betray him, and Jill assures her it was just a test. Jimmy wants to give Cynthia and Oz $1 million as a wedding gift. On the boat, Jimmy confirms that the money has been transferred. He points a gun at Oz, but shoots Frankie instead, explaining that Frankie, believing Jimmy had gone soft, would have killed them both. Oz attributes the softness to Jimmy falling in love with Jill. Jill arrives and jumps into Jimmy's arms. Oz, ignorant of the $1 million, asks Cynthia to marry him, and she accepts. That's the end of the whole 9 yards.
The plot synopsis there for the second half is one of the most complicated, convoluted things. Yeah. It's actually as long as the second half of the movie.
Yeah, it was
like, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah, too many directions that they go into, and they don't really focus on that direction. It just splinters off and fades out, and then splinters off again.
everything is just glossed over, and they try to tie it up as fast as possible. And it's like you're tying up one thing after another, and everything's so overly complicated. And bad technology alert, who in 2000 was still using beepers?
That's a good
cell
point.
Phones were widely used in 2000.
Yeah, no, you're right. Who is still using beepers? It's probably the tail end of beepers, or the Canadians are just far behind in technology.
I think what it was is I think that it was meant to be a joke because it buzzes and it scares him.
That's true.
Well, every time a phone went off,
very lazy.
Anything scared him. Yeah.
Yeah. Very right. lazy.
I like it very when Bruce lazy, says, "What's wrong with you?" And he's like, "I don't know."
Right. That is funny. I mean, there are some legitimate funny parts, and the whole idea of taking the teeth out and making teeth. It's like, I get it. He's a dentist.
Yeah. It's like, I don't think you can do that. Yeah, right. I was thinking of face off, actually.
That can't be done. Let's be perfectly honest. Dental records don't work that way.
I should cancel my dental appointment.
It's just, yes. It's kind of ridiculousness.
But that's the movie. The movie is ridiculousness. And I think
true.
I think that's what they're going for here. It doesn't take itself seriously. If it took itself seriously, then I would understand the problems that we have here.
True.
But it's
very
silly,
it's just very, very, very overly complicated.
I think they tried too hard to tie up loose ends and, like you said, kind of in a hurry.
And they leave a body in the house for the cops to find.
Yes.
Yeah.
They do all of this work once they find out the guy's an undercover cop. They have to dispose of his body. They're going to dispose of Yanni, but they leave the other two bodies in the house. Why would they do that? Are they going to come back for them? I mean,
why do you think they left two bodies? I know they left one body in.
You would assume that the other one was there.
So Yanni's burned up in the car. The cop they used his dental records to be Teddy.
Jimmy,
yes. And then the other one is.
Because there's four of them.
We're overthinking this one, aren't we?
Well, there's four of them, but there's four people in the car when they burn it up.
Mm-hmm.
Was there?
Yeah.
Was there? I didn't see four people.
I believe I saw four
I didn't
four
either.
People.
I just saw two.
That would explain if they put all four bodies in there.
They find one in the house, so it couldn't have been four bodies.
Well, they
in
have
there.
To burn up the dead cop, right? The dead, because they don't know where the dead cop's at.
We're overthinking.
Because the dead cop is at the dentist office. They don't bring him back home or anything like that. So
he's burned up with. Because
that's what
he's supposed to be the burn victim.
Yeah.
There's four people. So I think they purposely left one there.
When they open the door and the cops find the body.
Yeah, just so they know something happened. Some scuffle happened.
And
so.
How about those? Are those cops like,
I don't know,
reading
what they were
like
trying to do.
Cue cards when they're talking?
Not the best acting. Yeah.
They're like, so is this your car? Do you own a 2005 Toyota Corolla? I mean, I was like,
it's
like
Johnny
robots.
Five doing. Yeah, it's like Johnny
You're
Five
like
doing.
Robot police. It was just like, and Matthew Perry's like, yes.
Do you know where your car is?
The weakest police, seriously.
It does make me wonder, though, the undercover detective, was he really going to do a hit? Why was he recording the conversation with her? Unless he was going to like turn her in or something like that.
Probably. Who knows? Yeah.
It
hard
is confusing.
Telling because, well, that's another thing, because technically he shouldn't have been recording her because they didn't have a warrant. Oz and her have never been under surveillance by the cops.
Maybe Canadian law is different.
It's just.
Yeah, that's what happens when you go from Chicago to Montreal.
To Quebec. So we got to start looking at Quebec law.
You can't think about it a whole lot.
I try not to.
But it is funny how the cop gets Oz's wife to break under interrogation and she goes to jail.
Yeah.
Which is pretty funny.
I don't know, that fake crying kind of
got that's hilarious because
they're looking
it's totally her.
Yes.
It totally fits her character.
I guess.
Where she's trying to elicit sympathy but because nothing's real with her. It's all fake.
I do think it's funny her trying to do a Sharon Stone basic instinct type of thing, but she's like got all this crap all over her, so she's trying to act sexy.
Right.
Yeah.
But she can't pull it off. And that, to be very honest with you, even if she didn't have all that dirt and stuff all over her, I don't think she'd be able to pull it off. Yeah. As Jimmy says, I don't find your wife particularly attractive. Actually, I've never been a attracted to Arquette, but she's
Rosanna, like, or Patricia.
Yep. So.
Patricia when she was younger.
Or David. Let's talk about the elephant in the room here, okay? The thing that's on my mind.
Uh-oh,
here we go. Movie has an R rating. It's not an R rating for a lot of graphic violence and or blood.
Nope.
Ken, what's it an R rating for?
Nudity.
Gratuitous nudity. That's hardcore, right.
Hardcore nudity that Eric wanted.
I wouldn't go hardcore.
She was naked for a while.
She was, and I appreciate that. If I'm looking at it from a movie point of view, okay, the 1980s, clearly, you had your TNA in pretty much every comedy there was. Right. It was almost like a standard. This movie's 2000. So I'm guessing the plot line was, hey, let's have her be nude, come out there to startle the hitmen. They don't know what to do, and she puts a bullet in them. Did she really need to be nude? I mean,
no. How
hard was
lingerie
it for her?
Lingerie would have been perfect for this
Not even
situation.
Lingerie. Just come lingerie around the corner and take a shot. But I mean, seriously, just come around the corner and take a shot. Seriously, that's all you need to do. They threw this in for no reason at all. Granted, I appreciate it. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. But it really did not need to be there.
No, especially
if you're looking at it from a plot.
Especially when the director is very proud that they didn't use profanity or blood in this movie.
Right.
I mean,
right.
He's really, really excited about
He was.
About
That's
this.
Hilarious.
It's crazy.
I didn't know that. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
So profanity and blood we can't have, but, you know.
It's like when Bruce Willis's character finds out that Oz slept with his wife, and he goes on this tirade, but there's not a swear word at
exactly.
all.
It's during so that odd. Tirade. You're like,
it's
what?
Very true.
Yeah, you
see,
with my wife, there's going to be some words that are going to come out that are going to have to be bleeped out.
Now that I think about it, you're right. That is pretty funny.
And you could have easily, with the R rating, put that in. It would have given a little bit more believability to a Chicago hitman.
It is kind of shocking when she does come around the corner. It's
It's definitely because you don't see it cut. You're like, what?
Of course, because it's not hardcore because the railing
the banister,
is placed.
Yeah,
the banister's placed just perfectly.
That's right. Yeah.
Full frontal, man. You're not getting an R.
Here again, I think it's used for comedic effect.
I guess. I mean, I don't have any issues with it, but it just seems
odd. I don't have any issues with it either. It's just.
It just seems odd. Doesn't it?
It is. For it the whole
especially
tone of the movie.
Especially if you're trying to take the kids to go see the movie.
Right.
Because if you don't have the nudity, you probably
it's
have a
PG.
PG rating.
Yeah.
Easily
exactly. PG. I mean, there is some violence of maybe PG.
But even
13,
the violence isn't that violent.
No. Because like you said, there's no blood. He gets shot in the neck.
I think.
There's no blood.
That's the only blood you see.
No. You know
no,
where
there's no blood there either.
No. You know where the blood is? The most violent part of this movie is? Is Oz removing the teeth from the cop.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's the most violent part of the movie. I'm like, ugh, you know, that's it. That's the most violent part.
I think the nudity, unfortunately, takes a little bit away, though, from Amanda Peet's performance because it makes her kind of almost like eye candy when she
Cheap
does
and
such.
Easy.
Yeah, she does
it with gusto,
job.
Though. You have to
she
admire
does.
That.
She has a lot
does.
Of energy. I wanted to rewind and go back because talking about Amanda Peet,
of
my favorite.
You do. How many times did you rewind and go back?
Is this available in 4K?
No.
I don't know.
Sorry.
No.
It's available
no,
on
probably
Blu-ray,
not.
Though. It is available
on Blu-ray. Really want
the
to see the nipples?
Cut has a lot more scenes in it. Sure.
I do like Amanda Peet and Bruce Willis' scene when she shows up at the house and one tells him, you know, she wants to be a contract killer. And the reactions of Oz's face when this is all happening is priceless. But when they actually sit down and talk shop, doing the job, the hit.
Prior kills and stuff
it's
like
hilarious.
That.
Hilarious. Yeah.
They actually work extremely well. Like I said earlier, you know, the age difference kind of goes away because they have some chemistry here. And I think it's the energy level. I think he's the right amount of energy for her type of energy for it all to kind of work out. It's really strange how this works. I always usually, when I see a 20-year difference in age, I kind of get a little frustrated by it. But here, they have more chemistry definitely than Oz and Cynthia do. That's for sure.
Yeah, because Cynthia is Jimmy's
straight.
Age, right?
Her character's played straight.
But I mean, age-wise, they're the same about.
Maybe 5 or 10 years, maybe. But here's the thing, is you have Jill, who's been idolizing him for ages. So it makes sense that she would be like into him right away.
Absolutely. He's just impressed.
One of the best, though, is when they come up to the door and Bruce Willis has the look on his face like
what
oh
is
my
this
God, house? Did you bring a stalker? Who the hell did you bring over to my house?
Right.
That whole scene is hilarious. I love when
it might be my
together.
Favorite scene in the whole movie.
It's definitely one of them. There's a few different things that are pretty good as far as scenes go. It's just
how did Jimmy end up in Montreal? All he has is disdain for Canadian food, but yet he's not in witness protection, right?
No, he didn't want to go to witness protection.
Right. He just ends up.
So he just went to Montreal.
Okay.
I mean, there's really no rhyme or reason.
Probably thinking that no one would know him in Canada.
How many informants are there in Canada, I guess, right? Especially in Montreal, Quebec.
It is kind of interesting that you bring that up. He and Frankie set up Yanni to come to Montreal. Did he set that up with Frankie after he met Oz? Or did he scout Oz and know exactly the whole thing with his father-in-law and everything and just kind of set it all up?
Oh, you're thinking that was it random that he just moved next to him?
Right.
I don't know.
I think we're thinking too far into it.
But
coincidence? We're really mm-hmm. digging deep into this movie, huh?
Hey, yeah. Quick question. So Jimmy and Oz have nice houses, but Oz is in debt. How does Oz have money to like give his wife like $500?
$5,000.
$5,000. Five Gs. Yeah.
Five Gs. And
well, he is a dentist.
He has a dentist.
His office is in downtown Montreal. They say that he's not making any money, but the reason that he's not making what they think he should make is because he's paying off their debt. Because he drives a Toyota Corolla, but she drives a brand new Beetle, which those brand new Beetles back in 2000 were not.
Yeah, they were hot. So when they mm-hmm. first rolled out, yeah, he's driving this shitbox Corolla around.
He's made some money. I mean, he's still a dentist. I know they make fun of him because he's not making what they think he should make. But he explains that. He goes, I'm paying off you guys' debt. The thing with the money is just way too confusing when Cynthia and Jill go to the bank, because it took me a couple of times. I had to rewind it to figure out that Cynthia and Jimmy are not splitting the money, because I still don't understand it. Are they splitting the $5 million and are the $10 million? And he gives her $1 million?
He wanted him to have the whole $10 million for their lot, because easily he could just kill them both.
And, right.
You know, so they just made a deal. And it's kind of hard to see that deal because of everything else that's going on. And then at the last minute, he throws $1 million at them because, well, he likes Oz. Because
he's a nice guy.
He's a nice guy who's giving $1 million to a guy that slept with his wife.
Hey, just out of curiosity, have you guys ever seen The Whole 10 Yards?
Yes.
Yeah, but I don't remember anything about it.
You don't remember anything about it?
Definitely not. It's nowhere near.
I've never seen The Whole 10 Yards either, the sequel of this from 2004. Yeah, but yeah, of course you do. But is it any good? Is it even reasonably good as a sequel or no?
No.
I remember it being bad.
The same shit, just even worse.
Well, it's
they tried to change the characters.
That's a little too much. In fact, Kevin Pollak is actually in the movie.
Yeah.
As his dad.
No.
So he's got all this like crappy makeup all over him, prosthetics and things of that nature.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
It's not good. Especially Bruce Willis's character.
Definitely just a paycheck?
Yeah, it was just basically a paycheck.
They were trying to cash in on the $104 million that it made at the box office.
I guess so. That's surprising it made $104 million, to be honest. But
well, I mean, it's a fun movie.
Audiences liked it.
I guess it's a
romantic. Yeah, they did.
Technically, my wife asked me, she's like, is it a romantic comedy? I'm like, well,
no, in a way, it's not a rom-com.
In a way, it kind of is sometimes. It's very confusing to classify it.
It ends up at the end being like kind of like a rom-com, mm-hmm. but you're right. What does Wikipedia call it? I'm curious now.
I think it's probably called a rom-com.
Let's see.
When
crime comedy film. Okay. What do you guys think of that one? Crime comedy film.
That's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that. I can understand however you want to classify it, because I don't even know if the writers knew what to classify it.
But were you guys sad to see Frankie get shot at the end? I was kind of disappointed because I like Frankie.
Yeah, I remember being shocked when I the first time I saw it.
I didn't think he'd kill him. I really didn't. I really thought they were closer. I thought the code was closer with those two. But, you know, he made good points after he did it. He's like, you know, eventually he wouldn't think I went soft and he eventually would have killed me and came for the money. So there's, again, there's no code between thieves, right?
Right.
No honor amongst thieves, yeah.
We were talking about the whole 10 yards. What would have worked better is if they would have brought Frankie back. He had a bulletproof vest on.
Oh yeah, fell off the boat and
fell off the boat and he's seeking revenge. He's seeking to
that would have been a hell of a lot better.
That would have been a lot better than you just made a better sequel than the one that was actually made.
The whole 11 yards, and unfortunately, Oz dies of complications.
I guess it pays off in the end. You know, everybody ends up with who they should end up with.
Well, of course they do. Why wouldn't they? Come on.
I will say this, after he does kill Frankie, when he tries to throw Oz a beer.
It goes right by him. That is funny.
That is hilarious.
It's things like that that keep on making me smile throughout the whole
Chandler
movie.
That's Chandler Bing, man. That's it Friends. That's right out of the Friends script.
It's not only that, it's also the facial expressions of Bruce Willis. Yes. I mean, it's just the way he's reacting to Oz is great. And it's those things that really keep this movie entertaining for me.
Yes. Very
much
so.
You know, it would have been really funny if he threw the beer past him, it goes in the water, you hear this, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, you're exactly right, Ken. It's the interactions between the characters. Just when you think that it's getting, I don't know, overly complicated and everything, there's interactions, there's little things that legitimately make you laugh and bring it back to why, okay, this is fun.
The person that cast this should be given an award of some kind, because it is not the best script, it's not the best story, but the casting is near perfect. It's near perfect. I would say I don't think it's perfect, which is interesting because actually Bruce Willis's brother is the producer on this film.
Oh, is he really? I did see that Willis name on producer. I should have made the connection.
The actors here, I'm not going to go full that they made chicken salad out of chicken shit, because there are parts of the script that do actually work. The script is thin, we'll put it that way, and they do an excellent job for the most part, except, like we said, for Rosanna Arquette and Kevin Pollak. If you would have told me those would have been the two that would have been the weak links of the movie, I would have never have thought that.
She would have been more believable with just a normal American accent.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
The character would actually have been better. Yanni Gogolak, they grew up in Chicago. Just give him a South Side accent.
Exactly.
Give him a back of the yards accent. I mean, come on. It's right there. Do a Saturday Night Live Superfans accent.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, something.
Ken's exactly right. The actors here do a lot with
what they're getting.
Very thin.
Yeah.
Very thin script. It's definitely not the ref level. We'll put it that way.
Oh, no. No. Should we go into our reviews?
I believe it's time.
All right, Ted, tell us your review and your reviewer who you align with.
Okay, well, I aligned with Roger Ebert from the Chicago Sun-Times. Big surprise. He's my muse.
Shocking.
I know, right?
3 stars, right?
Yes. Just one quote from his review. A subtle but unmistakable aura of jolliness sneaks from the screen during the whole 9 yards. And eventually we suspect that the actors are barely suppressing giggles. This is the kind of standard material everyone could do in lockstep, but you sense inner smiles and you suspect the actors are enjoying themselves tremendously. I completely agree. They look like they're having fun. The interactions between the actors and the characters come off as believable. While the story may not be believable, it's the acting and it's the comedic timing of Matthew Perry and with Bruce Willis and Amanda Peet and even Michael Clark Duncan. They all make up for a very thin script. I enjoy the movie. I know I've been kind of harsh on it a little bit, but it makes me smile and it makes me laugh. It's enjoyable. So that's why I'm going to give it 3 hooks.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go a little bit opposite of you there, Ted. I'm going to go with Terry Lawson of the Detroit Free Press, who I think sums this up very well for me. He says, a movie that might have seemed amusing a couple of decades and four or five rewrites ago, but plays like an unsold sitcom in a post-Sopranos world. I think that sums it up very well.
It is interesting.
There's another reviewer here I'm just going to read just because it catches my eye. I don't agree with this, but it is kind of funny. It's Peter Howell of the Toronto Star. He says, almost everybody wants Matthew Perry dead in the whole nine yards. This would be a good thing if it were to stop him from making more movies. Mean.
Ouch.
Yes. Very mean.
Dear
very mean.
Lord.
So
heaven.
I know. I'm not picking that one. I'm going with Terry Lawson because I do agree this movie, in my opinion, was probably amusing when it came out. You're riding that friend's wave. Everyone loves Matthew Perry. The guy can't do wrong. So, yes, you're building it up for that. Watching this movie 24 years later, literally a couple decades later, and I don't know about four or five rewrites ago, but the movie does kind of play out like a sitcom. It does have those kind of sitcom-esque streaks in writing. The only thing it doesn't have is like a laugh track on it, thank God. I don't know about post-Sopranos. You know, you have to kind of go off that mob kind of feel. I think The Sopranos is, you know, one of the greatest TV series of all time, and there's no way in hell you could even match it. But the movie for me, it's weak. The casting is okay. It's fun, but it's not that fun. It's a movie for me that's very forgettable. You watch it once and you forget about it and you move on. Oh, the other thing, I give it an extra hook for Amanda Peet's nudity. That does bounce it up one for me, I'm not going to lie. So it bounces up from 2 to 2.5 hooks for me. Ken, take us home.
Well, unfortunately, the review that I was trying to use is not available anymore on Rotten Tomatoes, which is kind of strange. I don't know why that would be the case. This is kind of strange in the fact that every time I've done a review from this publication, it's usually been the staff from Variety. But this time, Todd McCarthy from Variety states, a director, Jonathan Lynn, keeps in a loose rein on the nuttiness, but never lets it get out of bounds and maintains the film's comic buoyancy throughout. The other reviewer that I have, unfortunately, I don't have that person's name, but they basically said what I was saying earlier in the film, that it seemed like they were having fun and that they could see it. So unfortunately, I wish I would have had that review to share with you all, because I think that's mine's a little bit more. But I also do believe that the director did a decent job of bringing everything back, where like Ted was saying earlier in the podcast, when it seems like it's about ready to go off the rails, it's kind of reeled back in. I think this reviewer says that very well here. So as far as a rating goes for me, this is a guilty pleasure for me. It's been for a long time. I'm going to give it 4 hooks. I want to give it 4.5. But
are you high?
Not high. Just,
are
it's
you
one
sure?
of those guilty pleasures. That
4.5
smile.
Hooks? Seriously?
I'm giving it 4. If you would have asked me maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I probably would have given it 4.5 hooks. The movie has slid down a little bit off my on my list of favorite movies, so I will stick with 4. But it makes me laugh all the time. It doesn't really get old for me.
So very wide-ranging from 2.5 to 4.
Yeah, potentially 4.5. Oh, my goodness. Are we watching the same movie? Is the Blu-ray different than the DVD?
More nudity.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course. Yeah.
Everybody's yeah. nude.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, that would definitely.
The all nude production of Pull the Whole Nine Yards.
But no profanity or blood or gore.
But you
got
to understand, you all have guilty pleasures that
yes,
you
definitely.
Love to death. This is not like on my top tier of love to death, but it's the next tier down. One of the reasons why I picked this movie was because I do like Matthew Perry. Because
there's not a lot of Matthew Perry movies.
There isn't a lot of Matthew Perry
no, there's
movies
not.
Out there.
There's not. No.
And I could have picked Fools Rush In, but that would have been more.
You did.
That would have been more for Selma Hayek than it would have been for
you.
Matthew
you picked
Perry.
The best one. Yeah, we all have guilty pleasures. I mean, mine is Draft Day. I could watch that movie and over again, and it's so
pancake eating motherfucker.
Exactly. It is such. It's such a bad movie, but oh my goodness. I get it, Ken. I get it. I would probably give Draft Day 4 hooks too, and you're probably, what the hell is wrong with you?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I get it. Okay. All right. Where can they find us on the World Wide Web?
We can be found on Twitter at HookedOn_movies. Come there and join the discussion. We're starting to become more active on X/Twitter before Elon shuts it down or destroys it or blows it up.
Or it's sold at a fire sale.
Yeah, exactly. Earth, we'll let Earth decide.
Yeah.
Whatever podcast version you're listening to us on, if you could, whether it be Good Pods, Apple, Spotify, leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It helps us get noticed, and you never know where that might lead.
Exactly. And I did forget to mention this. The next movie we're going to be looking at here in our final series of people we've lost in 2023, we're going to be celebrating Pee-wee's Big Adventure from 1985.
Was that to the porno theater?
Yes, exactly. That's the director's cut, of course.
You watch your version, we'll watch ours, Ted.
You watch whatever version you want, Ted.
I guarantee
you, might have a problem.
My version's going to be better.
Oh, come on. Paul Rubens, the great Paul Rubens, and a cast of many others we'll be talking about in 1985's release. Pee-wee's Big Adventure, a man who was so big in 1985, he got his own movie.
Feel free to join us on our Facebook page, Hooked on Movies. We discuss about movies. There's trailers out there. There's movie scenes.
Wonderful. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's all the time we have for the Hooked on Movies podcast. Please join us next episode where we are looking at Pee-wee's Big Adventure. As always, this is Eric. This means something. This podcast means something. Goodbye.
See you at the movies.
See you next time on Hooked on Movies.